What Facebook can tell us about the future of the social network. Some people are using the Photoshop for video in exactly the way you might think they would use it, and how to break the Google habit. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 17, recorded Thursday, February 1st, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a new podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes today. And by Quip. Make a fresh start this year with a Quip electric toothbrush. It cleans like a premium electric toothbrush at a fraction of the cost. Visit getquip.com/twit to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. Jason Howell is out sick today, but I am Megan Maroney, and I have a great show just for you. For you, we're clever Facebook, AI, IoT, and privacy. And I'll read some feedback from you. Apple just reported earnings, and spoiler alert, they made a lot of money. They sold fewer iPhones, but at higher prices. Imagine that. Frankly, I think Facebook's earnings were more interesting. So let's hear from Kurt Wagner on the financial health of the world's largest social network. Facebook released earnings yesterday, and joining us to discuss what this means for the social media company is Kurt Wagner, who covers social media for Recode. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Hi. So Facebook hopes that some of the changes it's making will make users happier, but maybe investors might be focusing on the potential downsides that Facebook is that the changes will have on the company's bottom line. What do you think today's earnings told us about that?
I think that's a fair way of thinking about it. So Facebook has been doing this thing for the last couple months where it's really started to say, hey, we want to prioritize the well-being of our users, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean spending as much time as possible on Facebook. Actually, in some cases, it means spending less time on Facebook, but the time that they do spend is going to be more meaningful. And therefore, you know, everyone leaves the site happier. They come back more often in the long term. But of course, if you're an investor, that's kind of scary, right? All right, less time for an advertising business usually means fewer ads and therefore less revenue. So that's kind of the balancing act that Facebook's trying to walk. And what we heard from the earnings was they came out and they actually said, hey, in Q4 of last year, we actually saw a 5% decrease in the amount of time people spent on Facebook. But you know what? That's okay because we wanted that to happen. We made changes so that people, you know, wouldn't see as many viral videos, for example, but they'd hopefully walk away from their Facebook experience, you know, happier and healthier and all that good stuff. And therefore, that's good for the long term. So that's the story Facebook is pitching. It's a little too early to know, you know, what the long term effects are going to be of that. But that's what they want people to believe.
So sort of like we meant to do that. Kind of situation.
We meant to do it. Yeah. We made changes. People spent less time, but you know, it's because of the changes we made. We're aware of it. And in fact, we did it on purpose.
Well, on the investor call, I mean, I think there was more talk of that, right? Like there were people saying that idea that yes, Facebook spending that much time on Facebook was making people unhappy and that can't be sustained. And therefore then they might leave altogether and no one will ever see your ads. Do you think that investors and advertisers are buying that?
I think, you know, let's put it this way. I was a little more concerned actually before Q4 because Facebook had said people are going to spend less time. They said this in early January. They said, we made an algorithm change to newsfeed. People are going to start spending less time. And I was sitting there going, you know, thinking exactly what we just talked about. Less time means fewer ads, which means less revenue. But what we found out, you know, at earnings this week, is that the less time thing actually started happening in Q4 and Facebook had its best Q4 ever, right? So The counter argument to this whole, you know, fewer ads, less revenue argument is that, well, if there are fewer ads, the cost of each ad is going to be higher because there's still the same amount of demand. So even though maybe it's a fewer number of ads, it's actually going to be more expensive ads, and that, you know, counterbalances what Facebook's trying to do here. So I think it's too early ultimately, but the fact that they saw a 5% decrease in time spent and yet had their biggest quarter ever revenue-wise in Q4, I think that should be a good sign to people who are worried about this long term, because at least for one quarter, you know, the less time spent didn't necessarily hurt the business.
So what about all the complaints about Facebook's role in the election and, you know, fake news and all that? I mean, that's basically that it seems like we've been talking about it forever, but it really hasn't been much more than a year. How has that affected their earnings?
It hasn't really thus far. I mean, so they reported their Q3 earnings literally the same day that they were testifying in front of Congress about, you know, Russian bots and accounts trying to kind of use Facebook to manipulate the election conversation. And, you know, they had a great quarter in Q3, and now they just had a pretty good financial quarter in Q4. So I don't think that there's going to be any harsh penalties other than a knock on Facebook's reputation. And that's where you kind of have to, you know, it's a little bit harder to quantify, right? Because the business seems to be doing well. But one thing we learned in Q4 from the earnings this week is that its audience in the US and Canada, kind of that really, really valuable audience for Facebook, actually shrunk for the first time ever. It was very small. It shrunk by 1 million users, so not by much, but it did shrink. And, you know, you could theoretically, you know, you could say, well, they just got done with a whole year of bad reputation. And is that going to impact maybe their user base in the U.S.? I think that's a very realistic possibility. We just don't know exactly, you know, where those 1 million people went or why they may not have used Facebook as often. But I think that's a real concern if you want to say what's the impact of all this Russia stuff.
Well, I know that Snapchat is always fond of saying, well, you know, it's not the amount of users, it's the quality users and their right. quality interaction. Is Facebook saying that yet?
Is some version of that, right? I mean, they're saying not necessarily quality users the way that maybe Snap does, but they're saying quality time spent. So they're using a similar approach, though, and just saying that it's not necessarily always about getting more of everything, more time spent, more users. It's really about, you know, finding in Snap's case, they say the users that are easy to monetize. So usually that means users in the U.S. or in Europe. In Facebook's case, they're saying, hey, we want to make sure that every minute that you spend on Facebook is well spent. So, yeah, I think that there's some similarities there. It's a little bit different in terms of what exactly they're measuring and kind of pitching that for. But I think the general idea that we want to have quality over quantity, you can certainly see the parallels between what they're both pitching.
Well, I know that I think it was a piece in Wire, the New York Times. Kevin Roos wrote it about how, you know, everyone's talking about how we need a kinder, gentler Facebook that's not full of spam and, you know, politics. Mm-hmm. And that's Instagram. They already have that.
Right.
Did they break that apart? How is Instagram doing in earnings?
They don't break Instagram out. You know, they do give semi-regular updates on their user base. So usually every 100 million or so users, they'll come out and do kind of a milestone update. They didn't do that this week with earnings. They do not break out advertising revenue from Instagram other than saying that it's an important part of the business. I mean, I believe the estimates are, and I'm forgetting them off the top of my head, but it's billions of dollars annually from Instagram that analysts think that Facebook is getting. So I do think that there's a kind of validity to that idea that Instagram kind of provides a version of Facebook, a feed that you scroll through with friends and videos and photos that doesn't necessarily have all the news elements that Facebook does. And you're not going to be, you know, maybe seeing as many stories about Donald Trump or politics. And I think that is definitely a valid point to think that, like, could Instagram be that version of Facebook without politics? I think it's an interesting idea. It's not nearly the size right now, but that certainly doesn't mean it couldn't be in a couple of years.
And what about WhatsApp? Did they report on how WhatsApp is doing, which they also own?
Yeah, they gave an update on WhatsApp's total user base. So they said that WhatsApp now has 1.5 billion monthly users, which is, pretty huge. I think Facebook kind of proper. Facebook's main app has 2.1 billion or something. So, I mean, WhatsApp is actually rapidly getting closer and closer to the main Facebook app. The thing that you have to remember about WhatsApp, though, is as of right now, it's still not making any money. So you have these 1.5 billion users using the messaging app every month, but there's no money coming in from that. And, you know, I don't think people are super concerned right now because WhatsApp has said, hey, we're going to get into this business of, you know, messaging like a brand or a business. So, you know, you might actually pay WhatsApp someday if you have a small business to use the service to reach out to your customers or to, you know, send promotions or something like that. So I think people see that there's a business potential there. But as of right now, it's not making money. So all we're getting is kind of these vanity user metrics. But, you know, WhatsApp's huge. I think the last kind of point I'll say about that is that a lot of their users are in markets that are not as easy to monetize, like Brazil and India. These are kind of emerging markets where there's just not really the built up like advertising business that you're going to have in the United States or in Europe. So it's a very different kind of business for Facebook. But there's a lot of people that think it could be really big.
And what about the Facebook proper? Are they moving into emerging markets still? Is that something they're concerned with, like Facebook Basics? We don't hear that much about them anymore.
Yeah, they haven't really talked about, you know, Facebook Lite or Facebook Basics or internet.org is basically the same thing as Facebook Basics. I think it is just rebranded. But the idea that, you know, Facebook wants to come in and give it kind of like a lower weight version of the app for markets where maybe connectivity is not great or the advertising industry is not really built up yet. They did say that of all of their, you know, growth for daily active users, most of it came from countries like India and Indonesia and emerging markets like that. So they did kind of give a shout out on the call that they're still getting a lot of new users from these countries. I think the point or the challenge is really going to be when can they figure out how to start making serious money from those places? Because if you look right now, you know, the US and Canada, I think your typical user in the US and Canada made about $27 for Facebook in Q4. Like that was the average revenue generated for each of those users. I think in Africa, it was closer to like $2. So, I mean, you're talking, you know, more than 10 times, a user in the North America is more than 10 times more valuable to Facebook right now than a user in Africa. So, you know, they have hundreds of millions of users in all of these emerging markets, and they'll figure out a way to make money from them. But right now they're still definitely, you know, they're in growth stage. They're not necessarily in monetization stage for a lot of those places.
Well, you can read the rest of Kurt's stories, the rest of his insights into Facebook's earnings at Recode.net, or he is also Kurt Wagner 8 on Twitter. Kurt Wagner, reporter at Recode. Thank you so much for joining us.
Cool. Thanks, Megan.
So Google also released earnings today, but I'll let you look that up. Ask Siri, ask Google Now to find out, because we're moving on. If you have children listening in the room with you, you might want to send them away for this next story or listen to it later, because we're going to talk about pornography and artificial intelligence, which has been in the news this week. AI is not only driving the next big wave of smartphone and in-home technology, it's also pushing advancements in the world of digital imagery. Joining us to talk about this and the future of face swapping by way of artificial intelligence is Katjana Kwatch, who wrote about this in the Register. Welcome, Katjana.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming on. So you wrote about a piece of software that makes face swapping into full motion video relatively easy. And like all great technology before it, people are using it for porn. Talk a little bit about Fake App and how it came to be.
So Fake App is a desktop app that was developed by this Reddit user who's just called himself Deep Fake App. And it makes it easier for users to map celebrity faces or anyone's faces onto porn actors in specific videos. And it's an algorithm that was developed by another Reddit user. I think he's called himself just Deep Fakes, but Fake App is basically a way for people to use that algorithm.
So what do you need to do this? What does one need to do something like this?
So you need to collect hundreds and thousands of images of the person that you want to map onto the video. So it could be a celebrity. That's what you need for the training data.
And so are these videos realistic enough to really fool people, or do they look like really bad Photoshop in video form?
Some are pretty realistic. There's like a GIF of, I think her name's Daisy Ridley, like the actress in Star Wars.
That's her name.
But some videos I've seen are kind of scary looking, like the eyes are out of position, the nose is wrong, the lips are wrong. It kind of depends on how well you can train your algorithm or how much training data you have.
Yeah, I think we have that Daisy Ridley image. It's an imager. Oh, no, we don't. I guess we don't have it. Maybe I didn't put it in for her own, to be nicer to her. I mean, if someone had done this to me, I don't think I'd be that happy about it. And I know you spoke to someone from Deepfakes, and they said, you know, there's nothing to stop people from using this tool for those reasons. But I guess I read today that they're taking some of these images down. Giphy Cat is taking them down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a picture of a really bad one.
Okay.
You can't make out who it is. But I think Kat said they were taking it down for moral reasons, which makes sense because, you know, you not only can you put celebrity spaces on it, you could put your ex-girlfriends or boyfriends or even go as far as children. You can just do whatever you want with it, really.
There are more important uses of this. For example, a lot of people are taking Nicolas Cage's face and putting him in every single movie out there. Here he is as Lois Lane in the Superman movies. So this is obviously a better use of this tool. So, I mean, we've had Photoshop for a long time. People are really good at it. Do you think this is going to, I obviously think video is different, but we've gotten used to Photoshop. We know not to necessarily trust a photo. Do you think that we'll probably just learn to not trust video in the same way?
I'm not sure because sometimes people can get tricked with Photoshop, especially if the results are realistic. And I think the same is here for apps like Deepfake app. If it's realistic enough, then people might believe it at first.
Mm-hmm. I guess that this is just the future, as you said in your article and quoting the Vice article. I won't use the word, even though I've asked for children to leave the room. I still won't use the word, but this does seem to be end times. But thank you so much for joining us, Katjana. Katjana Kwatch is an artificial intelligence and science reporter for The Register. She is moving in on Ian Thompson's area. So if you like his stories about science and the moon and all those things, check out Katjana because she has some great pieces. And you are pretty prolific as well, I think. Do you post about, how often are you posting stories on The Register?
I try to aim for like 2 a day, but it doesn't always work out.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Check out Katjana's work at theregister.co.uk. Take care.
Thank you.
After the break, if you're interested in IoT as more than just a buzzword, stick around because I'm going to talk to the co-founder of the IoT studio at Orange Silicon Valley about tech that helps us instead of replacing us. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this show, Command Line Heroes. That's a new podcast from Red Hat. Command Line Heroes is brand new. It's original. It's for geeks, by geeks. And it is dedicated to telling the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. Now, I am always looking for more podcasts about how people do the things they do. I find it fascinating. There was a hole in my podcast subscription page until I found Command Line Heroes. The show is for people who take stuff apart to see how it works, and for people who'd rather make stuff than buy stuff, and people who want to figure out the best ways to use technology instead of letting technology use us. If this describes you at all, you need to add Command Line Heroes to your podcast rotation so you can listen to the makers, the builders, the dreamers, and the doers who have come before us and those who are transforming technology right now. Command Line Heroes is produced by Red Hat, which is an open source company that started in an apartment 25 years ago and knows a thing or two about where tech is going and where it came from. And it is hosted by Suran Yabarik. She is a developer who founded Code Newbie. She also hosts two other tech podcasts and lives and breathes open source software. Here's a preview of what you'll get on Command Line Heroes. The OS wars travel back to the halcyon days of the 80s and learn how Linux came to be. Trace the development of the Agile movement. Get the real story of DevOps and find out more about the hidden warriors doing combat in the cloud. And that, my friends, is just the beginning. Subscribe to this podcast. Give it a listen. I think you'll be as inspired as I have been. Siron has a really nice voice. That's just a side note, but I'm very jealous of her podcasting voice. I think that's important. Visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts, and visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes for extras and learn more. That's redhat.com/commandlineheroes. Another week, another Internet of Things gone wrong story. This week it was Strava, the fitness tracking app that released a heat map that inadvertently revealed the location of military bases. How do we avoid these unintended consequences of all our IoT devices in hopes that they truly enhance our lives? To help us answer that question, I invited Michael Vladimir, co-founder of IoT Studio at Orange Silicon Valley. Thanks for coming on the show, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me, Megan. Excited to be here.
So first, tell us a little bit about IoT Studio.
Sure. So the Orange IoT Studio is part of Orange Silicon Valley. We're based in sunny San Francisco, sunny right now. And essentially, we are a research and development office. We call ourselves Innovation Strategy because we're outward facing. We don't just think that we have all the good ideas. We look to the Silicon Valley community to gather ideas from them and see how that could benefit our company, Orange, which our parent company, Orange, which is headquartered back in France, operating in 30 different countries around the world. You can see 29 countries. Very, very large company. Excellent website usage. So in that webpage, one of those programs is the Orange IoT Studio. And so we have a number of different programs focusing on different, you can call them hot topics. I have colleagues focusing on Bitcoin and blockchain. I have colleagues focusing on virtual reality and augmented reality. And I lead our efforts around the Internet of Things. And so I kind of have a breadth of different activities that I do. Part of it is doing proof of concept projects. So I look for up and coming companies that I think are exciting for some reason, that have some potential synergy with what we're doing here at the Orange IoT Studio. And I do projects with them. So one easy example is a company called Sutro. They make an Internet of Things pool monitor. So if you've ever tried to keep your pool water clean, you know it's really annoying and difficult. And so what's great about Sutro is it just floats in your pool, monitors the water, and tells you either, yes, water's safe, go take a swim, or no, there's something wrong and here's how to fix it. And so the Orange, being a telecommunications company, we're always looking for new up-and-coming communications protocols. So everyone's familiar with LTE and Wi-Fi. Orange is deploying a network called LoRa, L-O-R-A. L-O stands for low, R-A is, oh, sorry, long, and then range. So it's long range, low cost, low power. It's a really good protocol for Internet of Things devices because it's much cheaper and much lower power than, you know, LTE or something like that. So we did a proof of concept project with Sutro where we ripped out their Wi-Fi, stuck in the LoRa connectivity to demonstrate, you know, this is what the world could look like in the future with this new type of communications. So that's one thing I do. And then the other thing I do is around thought leadership. So I have a bunch of blog posts about how to think about the Internet of Things. One thing that I find really funny is that there's not a good definition. There's not a clear definition of what is IoT, what is good IoT, why. And so I at least try to put a stick in the mud. You know, this is my take on it and this is why. And so my answer for what is IoT, it's at its core, you have to have four things. If you don't have these four things, it's not Internet of Things. So it's sensors, communications, computation, and user interface. And the idea being that you have a device, you're going to use it to hopefully solve someone's problem, and you're going to pack it with sensors so that it gathers data about the world around us, and then it uses communication to send that data to the cloud where it can actually be useful. In the cloud, you run some computation, extract some kind of insight from that data, and then deliver it to the user through the interface. And so, you know, if you look at that and say, like, why isn't a remote control car IoT? It was missing that cloud aspect. You know, every single remote control car is in a silo. So I grew up playing with, you know, RC cars, and they're fun, but if you have a couple RC cars, the whole is not greater than the sum of the parts. Mm-hmm. But with Internet of Things, that's totally the case. If you have a bunch of IoT devices, all of a sudden they start to make each other perform better. So a simple example of that would be, you know, Amazon Alexa makes every other device in the smart home perform better, because now you have two interfaces to control your smart lights or your door lock. You can use your phone, or you could say, you know, Alexa, open my door, turn on my lights. So that's part of my work with IoT. And my latest post has been about something I call the 2080 rule of big data. And the idea being that, there it is, yay. So the idea behind the 2080 rule of big data is essentially a lot of people, especially with a business background, have probably heard of the 80-20 rule. So if you go down just a little bit, you'll see the 80-20 rule, the Pareto principle. So this guy named Pareto back in Italy, he noticed that the world is uneven, and that when he was harvesting the peas in his garden, that the fattest 20% of the pea pods actually held 80% of the peas. And so for him, that meant he could be lazy. This is great. So instead of, you know, taking a bunch of time to harvest all the peas, he harvested just the fattest 20% of the pea pods. And then he stopped and he saved a bunch of time and effort, because he could have kept going, but it wouldn't have really been a lot of work for very little benefit. And so the idea behind this 2080 rule is that when it comes to big data, when it comes to the Internet of Things, the Pareto principle breaks. It doesn't work. And it's because when you're dealing with IoT, in particular on data analysis, the x-axis should say analysis. I guess they haven't posted the updated version of this yet. But the key idea is that when you're doing data analysis, the first 80% of the analysis doesn't really solve your problem. You really need to go all the way. That last 20% of the analysis, that's where you capture a lot of the value, most of the value. And in that article, I kind of go into that. But that I would say is my golden rule, if you will, for IoT and what I really look for in IoT.
So one of those really interesting piece of data that was in the LinkedIn piece was that, 80% of the world's data what came online or existed in the last 2 years. So the world's data forever, since the beginning of time, 80% of that has been created in the last 2 years. That was crazy. And when you think, I mean, is that what you're talking about, the 80? Like, you need to, these devices need to look at all that data? I mean, obviously, they're not looking at cave paintings. So how does that relate to this story?
Sure. So those are two different percentages, so we shouldn't mix those. But the idea, though, is more to give context. I love working in tech. I love being at the cutting edge of innovation. And when we're at the cutting edge of innovation, it's really hard to see, you know, what's going on, because it's like right up, our nose is right up against it. So my rule of thumb is to say, you know, with 2020 hindsight, which is really clear, what did other people do when they were in a similar situation to me, and how did the world work? And so the idea behind that piece of the article around 90% of the world's data was created only in the last 2 years, in 2015 and 2017, is trying to understand that we're going through a paradigm shift right now around data. And people say, like, data is the new oil, but what does that mean? Like, how can you think about that, and how can you make that useful? And so the way I like to think about it is, you know, right now we're in 2018, but what if we were back in 1918, 100 years ago, or a little bit more? If we wanted to travel back in time before fossil fuels, before oil, and we wanted to enjoy this wonderful lifestyle that we have with, like, you know, our fancy coffee and our fine clothes and all the food that, you know, goes to the restaurants that we just take for granted. If we wanted to enjoy this lifestyle, each of us, we need something like a couple hundred, if not thousands, of servants per person. It's insane. It's just like, that makes no sense. And so if you went back in time, like 150 years ago, and you said to people, wow, we just discovered oil, and it basically means that man has untapped, unlimited access to power. What do you want to do with it? People would probably say something like, oh, I wish I had more candles, or I wish I had more horses. because they couldn't articulate, oh, I want a light, I want a flashlight, or oh, I want a car.
Or I want an Amazon Echo.
Or I want Amazon, yeah, definitely not that. And so if you take that perspective to today, the idea in the article is to say, okay, so now we're in this parallel situation where 100 years ago, you know, most of the energy that was ever consumed by people happened in just like the last few years. Up until fossil fuels, all the energy was people and a couple, you know, beasts of burden, but it was just a very different world. I really think about it like a light switch going off. Like, it's the difference between before and after. And that's around oil and fossil fuels and power. And we're in a situation around data where, again, 90% of the world's data was created in just the last 2 years. And if you ask, and so the question is, what does that mean? Like, you know, if you could travel in time to right now, what would you ask people? And I would say the question to ask people is, if you could know anything you wanted to know, what would you want to know? And because we have all this data, now we can know that. So you guys are up in Petaluma, I'm here in San Francisco. There's this classic problem in the Bay Area of how do you get between San Francisco and San Jose? There's two highways, the 101 and 280. And up until now, you had to just guess. And more often than not, you got stuck in traffic. And now, because we have all this data, we have Google Maps and Waze and all these things, you can find out in real time which is the better route, which one is backed up because there was a traffic jam and which one is wide open, you can fly. And the way I see the world right now, and the thing that really excites me about the Internet of Things, is anything that we want to know, we can now know. And the question, the issue is finding the right question to ask and going after that. And so that's the other kind of concept in that article.
So I watched a talk that you gave, and you said that IoT is consistently disappointing in repeatable ways. That, you know, that's the headline. That's the popular headline right now. Like, why do we need this? What, you know, and it's disappointing us in various ways, in repeatable ways. Can you talk a little bit about what those ways are and how we can change that?
Sure. So in that talk, I basically say, I give my recipe. I wish if I knew this was coming, I would have my pig with me, because I use that as my example of disappointing IoT. But the key idea behind repeatable ways is, if you take that recipe that I gave you, sensors, connectivity, computation, user interface, if you take that recipe and you apply it to IoT devices, I find that when an IoT device breaks some part of that recipe, that's where the disappointment comes in. So I kind of offhandedly started by saying IoT is there to solve a problem. And that to me is where everything starts. You know, if we're in tech and we're doing it right, we're all about solving problems. We're either going to like make the world stop something awful from happening, or we're going to take people that feel just okay and make them really happy. And so if you're building an IoT device, you need to make sure that you're dealing with a high value problem. How much is high value? If it's for a consumer, I say it should be at least $100. If it's for a business application, it should be at least a couple $1,000. Why? Because IoT is inherently complex. You know, why do I need a complicated light bulb or a complicated doorknob that if it isn't a lot better than the conventional light bulb or the conventional doorknob? So make sure that you're solving a high value problem. And then with those repeatable ways where it breaks, I've seen devices that have sensors, but they don't really measure a lot of data. That stinks. I've seen a really common problem I've seen is on the connectivity side. The connectivity is not easy to use. One of the lines I like to say is that people love their smartphones, but they only like their IoT devices. And so I've seen a lot of companies that design their IoT devices expecting the user to treat it like a second or third smartphone, and it's just never going to happen. With our smartphones, because we love them, and you can measure how much we love them because we pay for an expensive monthly data plan, we have this phenomenon where anytime we walk into a new place, we say, "Can I get your Wi-Fi password?" And we're always charging our phones. That's how you can measure our love. With IoT devices, if you try to apply those principles, especially around the communication side, where you want someone constantly getting it on different networks, they'll get it on a network once, maybe twice. After that, it's done. You know, I've met a lot of people that bought IoT devices, and they told me, the thing fell off the Wi-Fi twice, and I'm just done with it. I don't care enough. It's because they like their IoT, but they don't love their IoT. On the computation side, that also I've seen a lot of IoT devices that they don't extract anything insightful. Doesn't tell me, great, so you gathered lots of data, so what? And that kind of comes together with user interface. Help me make a decision. So in the 2080 rule article, the way I articulate this is kind of going from a conventional thermometer to a meh, disappointing IoT thermometer to a really great IoT device. So the conventional thermometer, we've all seen it. It's got mercury. There's nothing digital about it. You just read the thing. There's no recorded data. It tells you the temperature right in this instant. It's 62 degrees, and that's it. Nothing special. So the whole 2080 rule of IoT doesn't apply. There's no disappointment. There's nothing. Now let's say we IoTify that thermometer. We use a digital sensor to measure the temperature. We're sending that data to the cloud. Maybe we'll do a little bit of analysis. And more often than not, I see devices where it's like, right now the temperature is 62 degrees. And here's a nice little graph that shows what the temperature looked like the last couple of days. That's disappointing. That is not a helpful IoT device. It doesn't. It just spits the data back at the user. It doesn't solve any real problem. I call it just IoTifying for the sake of IoTifying. And for a very narrow slice of users, they want the cutting edge and they'll pay for that. But for everybody else, and these are the people that I really care about, you're not solving their problem. You're not making their lives better.
What problem does the Sutro pool detector solve?
So it solves a really important problem, which is my pool safe? And so, yeah, we could totally use that as a great example of IoT that delights. If you look at the status quo today, you have this, you know, device. You go out to the pool, you take a scoop of water, you have to manually add some droplets. And even when you look at those droplets, you have to use this color chart to match the color of the water to the chart. And it tells you the pH, it tells you the chlorine, but it doesn't actually tell you what you need to know, which is my pool safe? So what's great about Sutro is it solves the problem completely for the user. It doesn't just tell them your pH is 7.2 and your chlorine is 600. It says your pH is too low, you got to add, you know, three scoops of base to get it up higher, and here's how to fix it. And that to me is IoT that works.
Well, I have a smart lock that I really love, and I have smart. I'm going to say I love. I don't love it like my smartphone, but I really love it. And I also have in my house the Noon lighting system, which you can. It works. It doesn't have light bulbs. It's a system that where you can create different scenes, and I like that. I like that just fine. But I live in a family. My husband is not like any IoT stuff. He just wants stuff to work. So, like, how does that factor in? Where, like, I can use my phone to control the locks and you know, the lights and everything, but it has to work so that he can also just use the switches and a key.
So I'm not sure what you're asking.
Is that also, like, because some people, like, when you're talking about a consumer device that you're trying to introduce to someone, it probably has to do the thing. Like, my smart lock, also you can open it with a key.
Yep.
And my lights also, you can open them with, you know, you can turn them off and on with a switch. So is that an important, like, for people that live in a family where some people are more more excited to turn things on and off with an app, and some people just want the switch and the lock?
Yeah, well, I think that there's a bunch of things with what you're saying. So and this comes to the challenge of product design, where you have diverse audiences. Like, if everybody was just one type of person, it'd be a very boring world, but it'd be very simple to design for them. But because, you know, people have families, and I live with my fiance, and I've IoTified my house a bunch, and she generally goes along with it. It's a complicated world. And so one thing I talk about is having fail safes. So, like you said, you know, the idea that, you know, if the IoT side fails, you can still use a key. You're not locked out of your own house until the power goes back on or whatever. That's important. The example that I like to give of, the tech enthusiast versus everyone else is this company called Verdigris that I've also been working a bit with. So Verdigris is this really cool IoT system that monitors energy consumption. And for commercial buildings, like we have them installed here in our office. And the thing that I find so interesting with Verdigris is they have equivalent products on the residential side. And the thing that I find that's really interesting about that you know, let's say it's like you versus your husband in this case, like you're tech savvy, he's not. For most people, when they try to get something like an IoT energy saving system that they install in their house, they have a really bad experience in many cases because the deliverable from the product is a to-do list. It's like, you know, now that you've installed your IoT system, we're not gonna fix your energy problems, but we'll tell you how to fix them. So now you can take like the next 10 weekends of your life to fix it. For a few tech enthusiasts, that's great. They're like, yay, now I get to IoTify all my lights and the rest. But for the average consumer, that's not a really exciting thing. By contrast, with the Verdigris system, what I think is great is every building of size has a building manager. And that one of the things that that building manager is responsible for is improving energy efficiency and reducing costs. So now Verdigris is telling somebody, you know, you already have this job. We're already paying you to do this. Here is a to-do list that prioritizes what you were going to do already. And I think that's kind of a way to flip the script, if you will, from people that where the IoT product is making their lives worse to where it's making their lives better for people that aren't tech savvy.
Well, Michael, obviously we've just scratched the surface. I have so many more questions about IoT. I hope you'll talk to us again. But thank you for joining us. Michael Vladimir can be found at orangestudio.com.
Orange IoT Studio.
OrangeIoTStudio.com. And would you like me to give out your Twitter as well?
Yeah, please. Tweet at me.
Is that Michael Vladimir?
It's Mike Vladimir. On Twitter.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Take care.
You are probably familiar with the privacy-focused search engine DuckDuckGo. We've talked to founder Gabriel Weinberg before. Now DuckDuckGo has launched a revamped browser extension and an app, and Gabriel is back to talk about it. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you so much for coming. So what can I expect? Well, this isn't the right question because I know what to expect from the browser extension because, as you know, we've talked about how I've been using it. What can others who haven't had a chance to use it, what can they expect from it?
So as you stated, we've been running the non-tracking DuckDuckGo search engine for the past decade or so, and it's garnered about 16 billion anonymous searches. So we've kind of grown, and we can talk about that. But what we have a broader vision of protecting people in general across the internet, and we weren't really protecting people beyond the search box. So when you click on the results, you were being then subject to the privacy policies of those other sites. And for a long time, we've wanted to do that, but we were competing directly with Google on search, so it took a while. But now our app and browser extension will protect you beyond the search box. So when you click on those links, we're going to do a few things for you. We're going to block the hidden trackers, mainly from Google and Facebook, but other data brokers too. We're going to ensure that you're on an encrypted connection if possible, so your ISP can't eavesdrop on you. And then we're also trying to expose poor privacy practices where they're known, partnering with Terms of Service Didn't Read. And to put that all together, we're grading sites on privacy. So based on all these factors, trackers, encryption, and privacy policy, and in the toolbar of your browser extension, or if you're using the app, in the toolbar of the browser, you'll see this A through F grade that you can then click into and see how good the site is on privacy and what we could do to protect you a little better.
So who's doing the grading?
So the grading is us. We are having a transparent algorithm. It's all open source. And right now the grading is pretty simple. If you have a lot of trackers, you go down in the grade. If you're trackers are from a major network like Google or Facebook, you get a lower grade. And if you don't have encryption, you get a lower grade. And then finally, if TOSDR, and we're working with them to grade more sites, has graded your privacy policy poor, then you get a lower grade. So it's really those factors at the moment.
TOSDR, Terms of Service Didn't Read. I love that website. It's great.
It's great. the only issue with TOSDR, and we love them, is that they haven't graded a lot of sites because it's really complicated to grade these sites because the privacy policies on the internet are unfortunately generally pretty inscrutable to normal people. And so we're trying to do two things here. One is be way up the transparency on privacy policies on the internet and hopefully encourage some webmasters to make better privacy policies and get them graded by TOSDR. And then two, work with them to grade more sites more quickly. So they're working on redoing their infrastructure and we're going to be donating to them and trying to help more people work with them to grade more sites.
So you've been at this for a long time, and but now it seems like it's sort of a tipping point for regular people being concerned about Facebook and Google. You wrote on CNBC, to make any real progress in advancing data privacy this year, we have to start doing something about Google and Facebook. Not doing so would be like trying to lose weight without changing your diet. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what can we do about Google and Facebook?
Yeah, so to paint a picture there, which I wrote in this op-ed, is kind of people think of data privacy as kind of out of their control and nebulous in the big, bad internet. But in reality, these two companies, Google and Facebook, are a large part of the issue. In particular, these hidden trackers we're talking about, Google has hidden trackers now on 76% of websites you visit, and Facebook is on nearly a quarter. So that means that pretty much every site that you visit, it's likely that Google or Facebook is watching you there. And that's like unlike other companies. It falls off very quickly after that. Twitter is at 12%. And so the pernicious part of this is twofold. One is they're profiting off this personal information by enabling hyper-targeted advertising, which kind of at best annoys people as these ads follow around the internet, but at worst is causing major social issues like the election meddling in the U.S. or Brexit, or racial bias that kind of ProPublica has been reporting on. And then also on their own sites, they're putting people in this filter bubble based on the same data where they're showing you links that they think you're going to click on, but in reality, they're putting people in an echo chamber, which is also creating societal polarization. So what I'm arguing to do is block their trackers, which you can use our software or others to do so, as also switch away from their services. So switch away from Google Search to DuckDuckGo Search, or Gmail to Fastmail or some other alternatives. And for Facebook, it's a little more difficult, but I'm also suggesting that people disengage with Facebook or at least reduce their usage there.
Should we disengage with Instagram and WhatsApp too? Are those still okay?
I think that you should, because as of right now, Facebook is allowed to combine data across all three and they're getting put into the same profile. I honestly think that if Facebook was regulated, that's what I call in the piece, to restrict their ability to both target and combine data, then it might be less, compelling to disengage with it. But right now, I think that you should.
So it's interesting that you compare it to diet, because I've long thought, like, you know, using LastPass, a privacy manager, two-factor authentication, those kinds of things are like eating my broccoli. I know I have to do it. I don't want to. And I installed this browser extension. And the search bar search, the URL bar search goes right to DuckDuckGo. So I use Chrome. I'm used to going to Google. It didn't work like I wanted to. It tasted a little like broccoli. but I know it's good for me. So I've stuck with it. Like I know that if I keep eating the broccoli, it's going to start tasting better. You made a good point that just because it doesn't work exactly the way Google had been working, it doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just different and I'll have to get used to it. And it does feel better to know that I'm not just throwing all of this data at a giant company.
Yeah, I mean, we are trying to make it seamless. And our argument is that you can get essentially seamless privacy for the 80/20 on the internet with this app and extension. Now, there's some tricks to doing that. When you block trackers, it can break the web. And we've been very sensitive to that and been trying to reduce that from happening. With the search engine, it's a bit tricky. Our argument is we've been working on search for 10 years and we've really made it good enough to switch to. But you're right, it does work differently. So you kind of have to be in that mindset to be ready to switch. But we're trying really not to make it a sacrifice. It just is a little different.
Mm-hmm. So explain what hyper-targeting is and what are some of the scenarios that that can result, like the fear of what hyper-targeting can lead to?
Yeah, so there was a great video the other day showing all the different ways that Facebook and Google have information about you. And, a lot of people are thinking now that Google and Facebook are listening to them because the ads are so, on target and creepy. Like you talk to a friend and then you hear the same ad later. People conclude that they must be listening to you on your phone. But in reality, they're not listening to you. They just have so much data about you that they don't need to listen to you to make that so creepy. And these are data points all across the map. So if you're using you know, all of Google services and have an Android device, they're tracking your location everywhere you go. Same with Facebook through the app. They're knowing all your contacts, all your email, all your searches. And then they're combining, certainly Facebook is, offline credit card data. So a lot of these things that people find really creepy is they just talk to a friend about what they purchased and then they see an ad for it. Well, the reality is Facebook and Google know your who your friends are and they know what their purchases are. So they can target ads of that. Now, the hyper-targeting side is they're offering all this information to advertisers. So when you go on to Facebook or Google advertising platforms, you can target your ad very specifically to someone who purchased this product on this day or who just came to this conference or a variety of other behavioral targeting activities that people don't realize exist. Now, the problem with that is twofold. One, it's just kind of creepy and manipulative. But the other problem is more pernicious, is that advertisers can then run tests and they can figure out, run tons of different tests on different behavioral profiles or on the same behavioral profile, run different ad tests, and they can get the ad manipulative just enough to really convince people surreptitiously to follow the ad. And that's what we've seen in the election meddling. I think that's where it gets really scary.
So what do you say to someone who's like, well, nobody cares what I'm doing. Like, I don't, you know, I it's so much easier for me to use Google. I like Facebook. What do you say to people like that who say that?
I say these two harms are more personal than they are revealing your personal data. So I say two things. One is there's always areas of our life that we want to keep private and you wouldn't want other people finding out. And you don't want people profiting from or going ads against, like your financial and medical issues. That said, if you still don't care about that, there are two personal reasons why you should care. One is the filter bubble problem, where on Facebook and on Google, they're showing you things that you already agree with and they're putting you in this echo chamber. That's like a distorted reality field where you're not really seeing reality. You're seeing news articles that other people aren't seeing. You're seeing sites that other people aren't seeing. And over time, especially on search, when you're researching topics, that really distorts your view of the world, especially when learning things. And the second is these ads that you're being subjected to are really manipulating you. You may not realize it, and it may seem free, but you're probably purchasing more products than you would otherwise. They're subliminally influencing you based on these profiles. And I think once people realize that, they actually don't want that.
So when I used DuckDuckGo, when I used the browser extension and I tried to go to YouTube, it told me that it wouldn't let, they don't let anyone use YouTube without tracking them. So you're going to be tracked, which was interesting to me because having tried to look at my children's YouTube history, I know that they very easily could turn that off. So what that leads me to believe is that they're not giving it to me as their mother, but they're keeping that information. They have that information. If it's true that they're not tracking, they know what videos we're looking at, even if we're like erasing our history.
That is correct. We did several studies where we had people search in incognito mode. This is another pet peeve of mine, is incognito mode doesn't actually protect you for much, but this will illustrate it. At the same time, and we found that there was clear tracking between incognito sessions of what you were doing. And so there is tracking regardless of whether you're signed in or not, in incognito or not, or even if you turn it off or not, it's still happening. And really the only way to block it is to install an extension like ours and literally don't have the request go to them. Or on the regulatory side, if we decide as kind of a country or world to not allow some of this tracking, or if you really opt out, then it forces a real opt out where they can't collect it. That was actually what Do Not Track was supposed to be. That's another setting in the browser that hasn't worked out well. Happy to talk about that more if you like.
Yeah, I would love to talk to you again. Thank you so much. I know we've already taken a lot of your time, but this is fascinating. I do have one more question. Do you have an alternative for YouTube, or do you still use YouTube?
YouTube, unfortunately, and you'll see in what you're talking about in DuckDuckGo on the video search is we'll often have to link to YouTube and then have that warning. Unfortunately, a lot of the video content on the internet is on YouTube, and we can't do anything about that. The alternative that we suggest people use personally is Vimeo, and I use that personally for hosting my own videos and the DuckDuckGo ones. And you know, this is another scenario where Vimeo costs money, and you kind of get what you pay for. They have a nice privacy policy. You can delete your data, all that kind of stuff. But it's paid.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us. Go check out the extension. Go to DuckDuckGo. Install it. Just try it. Try it.
Thank you for trying it. I know it can be. I really enjoyed our back and forth conversation and happy to talk more about it. But I appreciate you taking the time and doing that.
And also, you can. We didn't talk about the mobile app, which is on Android and iOS. I installed it on Android, so you can do that too.
The fire button.
The what?
The fire button on the app is kind of fun.
Yes.
It's got a one tap and it just everything erases.
Well, thank you so much. And hopefully we can talk again. Happy week after Data Privacy Day to you, Gabriel Weinberg.
Thanks again.
Thank you. After the break, we have feedback and an update on Elon Musk's flamethrower. But first, let's thank my toothbrush, Quip. When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. Quip knows that. And they've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. And I'm going to show you. This is the one this is not my actual toothbrush because my actual toothbrush, my actual Quip is at home stuck to my mirror. That's another way to remind you to brush your teeth if it's stuck right in front of you. This is the case that it comes with, the travel case. And here's what it looks like. I have a rose gold one. This one is probably space gray. It looks good and it feels good. If you've used electric toothbrushes before, sometimes they're hard and they hurt a little bit. This one doesn't. It's very soft. It packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of the bulkier traditional electric brushes. There's no charger needed. So if we travel, you don't have to, oh, did I bring my charger for my electric toothbrush? It runs on a AAA battery that they will ship to you, or you can use your own rechargeable AAA battery and opt out of the battery delivery. Because while they're shipping you the battery, they're also shipping the replaceable brushes. They have 30-second guiding pulses that will tell you when to switch areas. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror, as I said, and then it unsticks really easily, so you can use the cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's just going in your gym bag, if you're the type of person that brushes your teeth at the gym, or your carry-on. No charges, no wires. Quip is compact and light. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip has a subscription plan. I'm a big fan of subscription plans. I do not like to think about stuff. I want my toothbrush replacements to come to me. They refresh your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5. That includes free shipping worldwide. That is way cheaper than the bulky brush heads I've been using in the past. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals. Quip will even give you tips on oral care that you probably never knew, like the fact that you only need a tiny blob of toothpaste. That's what I learned from Quip. I didn't know that. I thought you had to do the whole little stripe. A tiny blob will do it. And the Quip toothpaste tastes fresh. It strengthens teeth and gives your mouth the perfect minty clean feeling. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. Find out for yourself why. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/twit right now, you'll get your first refill pack free. That will last you a while when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free. Go to getquip.com/twit. And if you can't understand me, I'm going to spell it for you because sometimes people are like, Quip, what is that? GETQUIP. That's GETQUIP.com/twit. And we thank Quip for their support. And now some feedback from you. David from Alexandria, Virginia writes, with the push from companies like Uber to reduce individual ownership of cars, I see one major problem. One thing that keeps me from using car services is the need for a car seat. With children needing a car or booster seat for many years, the thought of taking a car seat in and out of a different car every time I need to go to the store or a doctor's appointment with a toddler running around sounds like a nightmare. No matter how advanced autonomous technology becomes, there will always be a chance for an accident to happen, making car seats a necessity. I see different ownership options becoming more popular, like leasing and care by Volvo to keep pace with advances in technology. Just curious to hear your thoughts on how companies pursuing the car sharing strategy will target younger families. That is a really good question. I had not even thought about it because my kids are far gone from car seats. And Uber and Lyft both have an option where you can you pay an extra $10. And then the car comes with a car seat already installed. That is for 12 months and older. So if you have like a baby, infant car seat, that won't work. So one thing I saw on Reddit, there was a Lyft Reddit channel, and they said, as soon as you're taking one of those car services, text the driver and say, I have a baby, I need a car seat, so pick me up in this safer location and leave some time for me to install the car seat. So good point. I hadn't thought of it. If anyone else out there has a solution to this problem, autonomous baby seats, let me know. We also got a email from Scott, who is a technology teacher. He writes, just want to let you know that I love this show. I was listening to last week's, and I think it was Megan that mentioned that Google's new IT curriculum is free. It actually isn't. It is through Coursera, and most things Coursera can be accessed for free, but the only way to access this content is to pay $59. I think that's the correct price. That's monthly, the $59 monthly fee. And that is correct. I said that it was free because Google is offering financial aid need-based, and you can apply for that up until February 20th. So if you want to apply, you can apply now. And if you for financial aid, you only have until the 20th to get that, and it's on a need basis. So it could be free. This week, Elon Musk surprised us once again by offering the Boring Company flamethrower for a mere $500, which I might remind you is a lot less than an iPhone. The devices are within regulation as they don't shoot flames further than 10 feet. I am not trying to convince you to buy one because they're already sold out. I hope you did get yours because Musk just added a few surprises to sweeten the deal. Each flamethrower will be marked with the number and order of which you purchased it, from 1 to 20,000. Also, it will come with a fire extinguisher. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. Subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me, I am Megan Maroney. Thanks to our TD Josh. Thanks to our editor, who's either Josh or Kevin. Thanks to our studio engineer, John and Alex and Burke. And thanks to you for watching Tech News Weekly. Jason Howell will be back next week, I hope. And we'll see you then. Come over here, Burke. Thank you.